LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
A king has his reign, and then he dies. It's inevitable.
These are ancient civilizations that were separated by centuries, and yet this same pictogram was discovered in every one of them.
I think they want us to come and find them.
Not a map. An invitation.
From whom?
No.
What did he say?
He's going to destroy the world.
A traveler from distant stars escaped from a dying world looking for a way to extend his own life. Body decaying and weak, he couldn't prevent his own demise. Apparently his whole species was becoming extinct. So he traveled, searched the galaxies looking for a way to cheat death. He came to a world rich with life, where he encountered a primitive race, humans. A species which, with all his powers and knowledge, he could maintain indefinitely. He realized within a human body he had a chance for a new life. Now, he apparently found a young boy. It says, as the frightened villagers ran, night became day. Curious and without fear, he walked towards the light. Ra took him and possessed his body. And inhabiting this human form, he appointed himself ruler. This mineral is clearly the building block of all his technology. With this, he can sustain eternal life.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Chris Hardy, who joins us to discuss her book, DNA of the Gods, The Anunnaki Creation of Eve, and the Alien Battle for Humanity. The evidence keeps accumulating from tens of thousands of Sumerian and Middle Eastern clay tablets already unearthed that we are the descendants of the gods of Sumer, and that the numerous striking similarities between the Bible scriptures and these ancient texts reveal that the deity in the Garden of Eden was the Sumerian prince Enlil, the commander of Earth. It is now clear that the events in Eden, also known as Sumer, were no less than a leap in the bioengineering of the present-day human race from the DNA of the aliens, or Anunnaki, who came down to Earth. DNA of the Gods probes many of the key questions arising from the Sumerian Anunnaki theory. Why did the visitors come to Earth in the first place? Was a massive planetary collision involving their homeworld Nibiru somehow involved in the formation of Earth? Was the passage of Nibiru close to Earth responsible for the Great Flood recorded in myths and legends worldwide? Were nuclear weapons used to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? Does the Sumerian Anunnaki theory help make sense of the deep-seated feeling that humans are somehow different from the rest of life on Earth, with which we seem unable to live in harmony? And crucially, has the misunderstanding and distortion of the Sumerian tablets, which appears in the Bible and other religious texts, burdened humanity with false concepts of morality and sexuality, which have in turn created a patriarchal world of greed and violence? Hello and welcome, Chris, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you, Greg. I'm very, very happy to be on Legalize Freedom Radio.
Excellent. Now, today, Chris, we're going to talk about your book, which is entitled DNA of the Gods. The subtitle is The Anunnaki Creation of Eve and the Alien Battle for Humanity. And before we get into that, perhaps you could tell listeners a little bit about your background and your career and how you became interested in this question of human origins.
Yes, well, I did my Bachelor of Art in sociology and then psychological anthropology, which we call ethnopsychology. And so I did that, and immediately after, because I was already meditating since I was 18, and I was getting all kind of state of very quite high consciousness and high state and of fusion with nature already and things like that, and also a wealth of spontaneous psi phenomena. It's like as soon as I started meditating, I had the possibility to see another level of reality, which now I have been able to express in a theory, my theory of a semantic field. And so I was seeing basically the semantic dimension of people, like their auras, or even places, sacred object. I would see their aura. I would see what's happening when somebody approach this object, how they put their own print and change the color or whatever of the aura. And that was giving me a lot of information, of course, on this dimension of reality that was not taken into account at all by science. And there was about 10 years of travel, intense interest in everything that had to do with spirituality, yoga, meditation, on the religious books of humanity of different cultures. And then I came back to get some more studies on the mastery and in the middle of travels, and then I went back really in science very seriously, because when I saw the state of cognitive science and the psychology at the time, I could not believe that even consciousness, you would not find the word, the term in the textbook. And so it was like we were a whole generation consciousness generation. We could be any age, but we were a whole generation of people totally implied, involved into the exploration of a dimension of reality that had absolutely no trace, no mention. There was no mention of it in any kind of scientific realm, domains. And so I decided that I had to try to bring about, to elaborate a theory of consciousness. Of course, at that time, I was not calling it a theory of non-local consciousness. It was not exactly existing. But I had, since my years of travel, I had used the term semantic field for myself, because I was I could never discuss with the people. There was always this barrier language. So I was learning by sensing the energy, getting into a shared state of consciousness with ascetics, with shamans, with very wise people all over the world. On semantic field, it was something like a shared semantic field, or the semantic field of a town, a sacred temple, a sacred place like Nasik in India or Benares. And so I was using already that. And so then there was, that was the mid-90s where I started to get elaborating my theory and publish. I published it in 98. And then I started to get involved into all the forefront sciences that could help me flesh out my theory in terms of dynamical network processes, you know, on those semantic field were, of course, dynamical networks. And so I was bypassing easily the old mind-body split of the Cartesian paradigm, which was totally materialistic, reductionist. There was only behavior and matter processes. And then I evolved more and more this theory. And next year, I'm going to put out a kind of crown of this theory, which is going to be on the pre-Big Bang, the dimension of reality before the Big Bang. But in the middle of that, I stumbled on all this information on Sumerian tablets, which they are in six or seven different languages of the Middle East, of Mesopotamia. And of course, the first one, pictographic language, is the Sumerian. And then you have the scribes say that they are copying an old Sumerian text, and they are copying in Assyrian, in Babylonian, in Akkadian, and finally it will from the Akkadian it will get to the Hebrew language. And what I discover in this Sumerian tablet was a whole dimension of our origin, something that has been totally suppressed and framed into a new paradigm of morality, of patriarchy, of authoritative style of relationship, of idealization, progressive idealization of the deity into an aggregation of all positive qualities. And of course, the opposite, the aggregation of negative qualities into the persona, of course, not the real person, but the persona of would-be satanic being. Because you had also to find somebody to carry on and to be responsible of all the mess that we can find around, and all those absolutely terrible drives of humanity, which, as we know, is always on wars, on destruction, on control, on super control, on hyper super control, and that's it. So yes, I'm totally very, very sensitive to this fact that we have, in order to free ourselves and to get free, we have to sometimes, once in a while on our path, we have to really plunge backwards, you know, into the roots of our human origin. And of course, we are going to be confronted by that very, very quickly. So it's like we have very little time, in my opinion, to clean. I don't know how you would say that in English. We said to clean the sheets in between the family, you know.
Yeah, it's clean. Wipe the slate clean.
Yes, exactly. Because soon we are going to be confronted by some people who would know everything about our history, you know. So I think we better move on quickly. Yes.
Now, this idea of there being some genetic engineering, DNA crossbreeding interference with the development of humanity in high antiquity, this is not new by any means. It's been out there for quite a long time, and it's one of the most contentious theories out there. I mean, one guy who you refer to a great deal, who did a lot to popularize this, was Zechariah Sitchin, and his work was very controversial. A lot of people say it's been debunked. However,
your book is just yet more evidence that this idea about how humans came to be the way we are, this idea just won't go away.
It's more than that. First of all, Xi Jinping was an expert in many Middle Eastern languages, including Hebrew, of course. He was a Bible expert in Israel, which says something about his, the quality of his work. And he was the first one to really understand that you needed a new paradigm in order to translate correctly those ancient texts. And of course, it's something that now there is an emerging movement of collective consciousness towards the recognition. I mean, of all the signs, you know, that are left all over the planet of a very ancient civilization that was highly developed in terms of technology. We still are unable to understand how they could move blocks of 1,500 tons, you know, like in Baalbek, like in Tiahuanaco. So basically, on more than that, in the tablets, we see a lot of things. I mean, it's impossible to understand otherwise why they would have a medicine able to revive somebody so to revive somebody who has been dead not too long, like we are able to do now. And also they definitely talk about a hybrid, creating a hybrid race, so that this could be workers that would be used in the mines to extract gold, which they needed. And you have, on the contrary, when I was reading some translation from people that were trying to grapple with strange ideas, you know, and they came with sentences that had absolutely no meaning, no sense. You could see perfectly well that, I'm sorry, but I'm very, you know, my whole theory is about semantics. And I'm extremely keen, without too much pride, but I'm very keen in being able to, for example, I read a book translated in French, and I would spot any bad translation of a word. And not only that, but I would immediately find the real word that was in English and that had been badly translated, including sometimes sentences that has been put in the positive while the guy was trying to say the opposite. And so you have a part which is logic, you have a part which is a sensitivity to the kind of semantic field of this researcher about his values, his logic, his way of his worldview and all that. So it's the same for me when I read a very ancient text. I mean, you can see that this sentence, you have something explained like, okay, the assembly of the gods is getting together to treat this problem. And suddenly you have a sentence that means nothing. It means that a certain word had not been translated correctly. And that's what Xi Jinping did. He was the first one to do that. And he's now... I mean, you can say, I mean, the latest polls, let's be clear, were that polls from 2011, were that 56% of the American public believe that there is life somewhere else in the universe. Intelligent life, sorry. And a great number, I think it was like between 36 and 40% of people believe that these intelligent exo-civilization have been able to interact with us, I mean, to come to Earth, had the technology to come to Earth. But if you understand that we are 4.5 billion, our planet is 4.58 billion years old, you understand that you may have a planetary system that has been, that have been formed a million years before us, and also a million years behind us, because we are in the mean time for the formation of our solar system and our galaxy. So this of course, now, you know, it's impossible for any researcher not to accept that there is intelligent life elsewhere. I mean, it's just so stupid to imagine that we are alone there, you know, in the whole cosmos.
For people who don't know, perhaps you could just tell us, briefly summarize the theory with regarding Nibiru, Tiamat, how the Earth was formed, and why the Anunnaki came to Earth in the first place.
Well, in fact, I just posted 2 days ago a synthesis of this research on nomad planets, because it's very, very new. It's only since 2011 that, I mean, it's like we are doing a leap in terms of opening up to this kind of subject, you know, of extraterrestrial lives and habitable planets and nomad planets and all this in the last few years only. And so basically I did a post on that. So because in the Sumerian tablets, what they say is that they were on a planet which now we call nomad or wandering or rogue planet, but I don't like rogue, of course. So they are nomad planets that are 100,000 times more numerous in the universe than planets that are attached to a normal sun, to the solar, as a within the solar system of a sun, okay? And so we have this gigantic number of wandering planets, nomad planets, that are just circling over the center of the galaxy, like all solar systems do, but they are by themselves. However, if one of these planets approach its course, its orbital course around the core of the galaxy, if by chance they approach too much, too near to a solar system, then they are going to be caught by the gravity field of this solar system. So now we know it's happening like that. And once they are caught, they are going to get into orbit around the sun of this solar system. And it so happened that this is exactly what you can find in the tablets, you know, in dating back 3,500 years at the minimum, because this is as far as we have discovered ancient clay tablets. And this is what is described in those tablets. It describes that there was a planet named Nibiru, ruled by a king called Anu. And this planet at one point started crossing our solar system, and they describe one by one the huge exterior planet when they cross them one by one. And it was absolutely incredible that the color, the moons of Jupiter, the moons of Saturn were described, the number 4 for one, 7 for the other one, of the major moons of those two planets, the color and the texture of the planet, and something which has not been corroborated yet, because all this has been corroborated, the color, the moons, everything. But when has it been corroborated? Only when we sent the Voyager probes, that means between 79 and 89. So this is highly interesting. And another point that has not been corroborated still is the fact that, but it's on the verge of being so, it's the fact that Mars had water and they stopped there to get some water. But we are talking about they came on Earth. And when they approach the Sun and Earth, at that point, they kind of jump on Earth, you know, with their spacecraft. And the first one was Enki to do that, and in search for gold because their atmosphere was damaged. And on the way, they had one of their moons crash into Tiamat, and that's the big planet you were talking about, because it has the same name as Eve. This is interesting. It's like their planet was called Nibiru, but also Heaven. And it seems like when they genetically engineer the first woman, which we call Eve, and they call Tiamat, as if they were engineering Earth, you know. They were Heaven, and they engineer, they call the first woman Earth, which was a very interesting point. So one of their moons crashes into this gigantic planet that was there, which was called Tiamat, and which was, of course, considered a being, you know, a goddess. And doing so, a big chunk of Tiamat exploded in hundreds of millions of thousands of debris, which are now circling on the same orbit where the planet was. And those debris field, we call them the asteroid belt, but they did call them at that time the Hammer Bracelet. But they explain how this asteroid belt of millions of chunks, tiny to huge ones, came into being. And this is very, very consistent with our scientific understanding. And another part of this giant planet Tiamat, the part that did not explode, was by the force of the collision was kind of pushed further inside towards the Sun on a more closer orbit to the Sun and became the Earth. That's what they say. So this is very interesting because, again, in the last hardly 2 or 3 years, we see that the most, of course, there are different interpretations as to the formation of Earth, but the most serious interpretation, the one that is has the most the greatest probability of being true, and which is accepted by the majority of scientists, is that, in fact, Earth was formed by a collision, an enormous impact of a collision with a celestial body the size of Mars. And that's, again, each time we keep going, you know, we every every new discovery in that are touching on some domains that are explained in the tablet, it's always science corroborating the possibility, not the fact that it was like that, but at least a high possibility that indeed it's what happened.
It still remains a major mystery as to how humans seem to have a sudden spurt of development hundreds of thousands of years ago, seemingly developing, you know, brain capacity in a very short space of time. And this actually, the developments that have been seen by sort of anthropologists, and this does overlap with the timeline that you're talking about, specifically going from Homo erectus to Homo sapiens about 300,000 years ago. And this ties in with the Anunnaki theory.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, the time again, the time frame is, the data, the scientific data are totally in accordance with the Sumerian tablets. And the remarks that Sitchin did this translation and then got some conclusion, his own theory about what had happened. Sometimes before we were able, science was able to catch up, you know, with those kind of domains. I'm talking, for example, about the capacity that we have for cloning. It's so, such a few numbers of years, you know, since Dolly the sheep. And what about hybrid? Starting to tinkering with human whatever genomes, you know. So it's of course extremely frightful in for me in a way, because knowing the kind of crazy people that are holding power, you know, and whatever they are able to do, I'm not inclined to give them more power to do whatever they imagine, given that for now the only thing they have been able to do since we were created and after the first time where you had this family of gods, you know, and you just had feuds between brothers and sisters, and at least everything was clear. In the tablets, you know, what you see is that you have two contenders that are the sons of the king Anu, and who came on Earth, and the sister with Ninma, the head scientist in engineering, and in genetic engineering and life science, and while Enki was a head scientist in all other sciences like astronomy and everything. And we see something very clear. They are making wars all the time. You have one of them willing to keep the human race bound to be inintelligent and able to work, you know, and to follow orders. And the other one, Enki and Ninma, the other ones, Enki and Ninma are, on the contrary, willing to give the new humanity that they have created with Hermes. They are willing to give humanity more and more knowledge, and they keep upgrading the new hybrid DNA between the Homo erectus and their Anunnaki genome, which in my opinion is about 90% our own genome and 10% different, because they had immortality. They did not give us immortality. And it's very clearly said in the tablets. Enki gave man knowledge and wisdom. He did not give Adamu immortality. So this is very clear, and it was, in my opinion, a very, very intelligent long-term strategy.
You touched there on one of the most fascinating parts of the book, which talks about, as you say, the first modern humans, the Adam and Eve story. You also do quite a bit of biblical interpretation in the book. And obviously, that was something that, Sitchin did a lot of. And what it reveals is that the Adam and Eve story, as it is in the Bible, not only did it not really happen like that, but if you interpret the Bible more accurately, it doesn't actually even say that in the Bible, which you refer to as the book. That's just bringing together all the main religious traditions and writings. And there's also the issue then of biblical events, particularly non-religious people are inclined to dismiss virtually everything there that it couldn't possibly have happened. But you also point out in the book that the very meaning of the word myth has been altered over time. And with that background, there's no reason to think that a lot of the things, people, places, events in the Bible, they may not be accurately reflected, but there's no reason to think that none of that ever happened or ever existed.
Yes. I mean, your question is definitely a load of different questions. The most important point to for somebody researching this era, and I must say that I have done a very original work on specifically on the analysis of the book text. And because, you know, a name is also a semantic field, as I've tried to explain, and it carries, you know, a whole semantic constellation of belief, values, worldview, interdiction, rules, and a whole paradigm of even relationships style, and especially the worldview, the general worldview. And so, in order to stay free, in order to be able to analyze a text, you have to take some distance. And basically, what happened is that it was all spontaneous. Is that first I read this incredible scholar who had been able to foresee a lot of real interpretation that, in my opinion, will be only corroborated. And then reading the tablets and the text, and suddenly I was absolutely appalled to discover a wealth of information that had been thoroughly suppressed. And when it had not been suppressed, it had been little chunks like this, wrapped inside a totally new, different framework, and maybe even stick into a frame that was extremely constraining in all kind of terms. And so you have you can see so clearly the difference in semantic field between the editors of the Bible. We think now that it had the most chances of having been written during the captivity in Babylon. And so basically, you have a lot of similarities with Sumerian text, Sumerian and all the others, Sumerian text. But Sumer was a word of Mesopotamia. And you have so many similarities that you have to accept and recognize that they have taken their source as far as the most ancient past of humanity is concerned. All the sources of information are into the Sumerian tablets. However, you can see a totally different layer of text that corresponds to a totally different semantic constellation, which has a totally different worldview, on values, on the relationship style, on the teaching style, everything. The Anunnaki were not trying to teach. Enki was always on Hermes, on then the line of kings that Ninma offers them the kingship of her town, her city, Shurpak. So this is much before the deluge, even. So you have the Enki's clone, which is always to give them as much as he can about knowledge, science. I mean, you see Enki or one of his sons taking Adapa to the moon to teach him astronomy. And he was the one, Enki, to divide the ecliptic into 360 degrees, to name the constellation, into 12 parts, you know, the ecliptic, and engineering works and all kind of things, and of course Ninma with genetic engineering, and we see them all the time trying to teach as much as they can, and they keep upgrading the genome of the new species so that they can become the highly civilized man, because the first one, what they wanted was civilized man, and the first successful result of Ninma's genetic engineering was Adamu, Adam in the Bible. But then you see that they keep upgrading the genome, and when they after Ninma is creating Eve, Tiamat, it's like she has already an upgraded genome, and then she keep upgrading the genome until Noah, and in between we have 10 kings of Shurpak, Adam Adapa being the first. And so you see them trying to give to humanity the best. We see them in the depictions, they are always on a par. They put them on a par, you know. I mean, when Noah was going to Enki, trying to say, because Enlil was trying to erase humanity by drought and then by a kind of pandemia, and he had order to the other gods and goddesses not to give food to the human beings, that he wanted to erase them from the face of the earth. And then after, with the deluge, which was a natural catastrophe, but they did everything. Enlil forced the other god to not to say, not to reveal what was going to happen, and they were going to orbit around the earth, and they did that. And hope that the Enlil hopes that all Earthlings would be erased with a totally absence of vision for the future and everything.
Now, you mentioned the deluge there and also Noah, and this might be in people's minds at the minute because there's just been a new Hollywood film all about this. I've not seen it myself, so I've got no idea what it really gets into. I suspect it's probably a pretty straight telling of the Bible story. But we have worldwide myths, stories, and other accounts that talk about this great flood. So there might not be any physical evidence for it, but as I mentioned before, these stories have come from somewhere, and they say that they're universal. But it's interesting, in your book you get into what actually caused the deluge.
Yes, because in my book, in the Sumerian tablets, we see them, first of all, you know, you have to understand that when they came, the first time they crossed our solar system, which is perfectly explained in the Epic of Creation, the first time they came into our solar system and they collide with Tiamat, their moon, of course, one of their moons. At that time, they understood, Enki, who was the head scientist, understood very well that there was always this possibility that at one point their planet again was going to crash into one of the other celestial bodies of our solar system, including all these asteroids. And because their orbit, when they start orbiting our sun, their orbit is an ellipse, extremely flattened and extremely long, that goes very far behind Pluto. And so basically they have to cross all those orbits each time every 3,600 years. And so there was always this possibility that there would be another catastrophe happening at each perigee of on each crossing of our solar system by their planet Nibiru. So what happened is that they even install. It is said in the tablet that they install a laboratory at the tip of Africa where the gold mines already. Eresh Kigal was the one to take care of this laboratory, and they were monitoring, let's say, the crossing of Nibiru and what was happening on the ice cap. It's like there was a problem with the ice cap, and indeed, at one of this crossing, Nibiru coming to this perigee near the Earth. It had, while it was crossing the solar system, it had already warm up. There was something strange going on. It had warm up the planet that had gotten higher in temperature, as we have seen in 2012, which was very strange. I'm not sure what's happening now, but I know that there were a lot of different signs of some kind of modification of the normal behavior of geological data, you know, monitoring. And so they have this monitoring laboratory. And they see at one point that they calculate that Nibiru, often their computer, because they had computers the size of diamonds, you know. And they see that they forecast that Nibiru is going to come too near to Earth, and it will provoke an enormous deluge, you know. And so they start, instead of preparing for this deluge, and, which I believe Enki did because he had vision and he was able to anticipate. And he had all the time anticipated that this could ever happen at one point, including the fact that it could. It was also in the possibility, among the possibilities, that Nibiru would crash itself as a planet into another celestial body and then be gone. And in my opinion, this is why he was all the time trying to push the evolution of humanity in terms of science, of knowledge, of everything, poetry, writing, so that we could take the lead at one point. But to get back to Noah, which was your question, so basically when they have forecast that there would be an enormous deluge on Earth and also a tsunami planet-wide, Enlil, as he was the commander-in-chief, I mean the legal heir of Anu, and he had the title, he was giving the orders, but with the Assembly of the Gods, however, it seems like whatever he wanted, the Assembly of the Gods was kind of going with him. And so he decides that this is, as he has not been able to get rid of humanity, because the astronauts, which were on a base on Mars, and we are going to see that very soon, you know, we are going to find those runes on Mars, on the moon. How are we going to explain them? But we have them described in the Sumerian tablets. So we will at least, I'm sure there are other aliens that have come by apart from the Anunnaki. And I'm sure that a certain amount of data is also not in the tablet, because they, of course, had interaction with other alien civilization in the universe. But this is, we have not been able to find those tablets speaking about that, if they ever told us. But so basically, Enlil decides that since he has not been able to get rid of humanity through the drought and then through the pandemia, now he's going to get rid of humanity through the deluge. And he forces the other gods not to disclose the information to the Earthling. And what happens after that is exactly in the Sumerian tablets as in the book, is that, but it's not the same God. Again, it's not the same God who created us. It's not the same God who saved us repeatedly, and especially during the deluge. And it happens that Noah was the king of Shurupak, so he was a familiar, a friend, because Ninma and Enki were treating the Earthling on a par, you know, on par, sorry. And so basically, he, and on top of that, Noah was not only a new upgrade in our Earthling genomes, but he was also the blood son of Enki, because Enki had his own way to upgrade our genome by making love to all those young women. And so he was also the son of Enki. And Noah and Enki decides that he's going to save Noah because he's bound by the oath that has been enforced on him by his brother. But he's able to say to, he's talking to the Red Hut because he has no right to disclose the information to Noah. But in the tablets, you have this incredible scene where, and also on depiction, where you have Enki talking to the Red Hut where Noah is sleeping, you know, and he's saying, "Red Hut, Red Hut, listen to me, listen to me. The gods have decided to get rid of humanity, and but there is a catastrophe coming." And then he gives them, gives him, of course, all the data to be able to construct a submersible, as we know well. But when we read the Sumerian tablets, we fill in the gaps, so many gaps that make a much later rendering of these events kind of very strange and magical and impossible to understand, you know. But when you read the tablet, it's kind of nearly perfectly coherent in terms of scientific data.
Now, a lot of this hinges on the sort of superhuman abilities that these beings apparently had, though it's worth mentioning that we do, of course, have ancient accounts of people living much, much longer than the humans like us do. And also, a lot hinges on their science and technology. And a lot of it, it's easy to look at it and dismiss it and say, well, that's not possible, that can't be done, they couldn't have done that. But of course, you point out that we're looking at it through our own paradigm of what's possible and our own prejudices as to what can be done. And you look, for example, at all the many, many illustrations across the world for what appear to be flying machines that go back, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And the mainstream view is, well, clearly they're not flying machines because they didn't have flying machines back then. Well, we don't know that for starters. And also, as I say, we're constrained by how we do science and what we think is possible today. And it was Einstein who actually said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right, absolutely. And this is it. But now we, the first translators, they had, let's say, some good reason not to believe, because we had not come up with Dolish the sheep. We had not started to tinker with genomes and DNA. And we had not any notion of nomad planets or the formation of Earth or whatever, or that there was indeed water on Mars extremely long time ago. But I do believe that the new researcher in ancient aliens theory are doing an incredible job. Of course, all our listeners know about this incredible History Channel TV series. But it's like, you know, the signs are everywhere. The signs are everywhere. It's just the blinkers we had. And also, not only the blinkers we had, but why did we have these blinkers? That's what we have to ponder. It's because people, some shadow powers that had taken the power, that thought that humanity had to be driven by fear and by, you know, the stick and rules, and because who knows what would happen? Always the fear that you find everywhere. You know, you just have, with a different context in on paradigm of reading the text, you can see it's all there. It's all there. It's perfectly coherent. The fear that we would be like them, the gods. It's very, very clear. And so we really have to take a leap, because we have very little time to do that. We are soon going to meet officially what has been going on since a long, long centuries, you know, and especially since 47, 49. And so we are going to meet those other civilization, intelligent exo-civilization. So that's it. We have to get ready to, in a very, very few years, you know, we are going to be discussing with people that are definitely exo-civilizations and highly evolved. And our problem now is not to keep trying to do the math, you know, the math are on our side. I mean, the more we do the math, the more we discover, the more they are on our side, that it's impossible that they would not have evolved a technology that we are going to evolve in a minimum 100 years to go from a planet through wormholes beyond space-time dimension, you know. Okay, and our planet is our problem is not that. Our problem is exopolitics. What do we have as a planet that can be of very high value for them that they don't have? It's not going to be technology. That's absolutely for sure. But we have a lot of extraordinary qualities that we have developed. And one is our incredible sense of freedom. And I really thank you for this beautiful name you have given to your radio, because it's very, very important. Thank you, Greg.
As you pointed out, we've already alluded to this, but the effects of misinterpreting and misunderstanding and even misrepresenting some of these myths and some of this history, particularly as it appears in the Bible, it's had an enormous effect on us, women in particular, and their sort of role within the human family, but ultimately everybody. And that these ideas of a wrathful God and original sin and all the negativity surrounding sexuality, that has been with us since those days, since it was written down, misinterpreted, and we are still dealing with the aftermath of that.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. And this was the most appalling realization when I got into the Sumerian text. It was that how could we have been lied to such an extent? How did they shape our new human psyche, collective psyche, into those horrendous, culpability and the original fault. And here you have this young girl, pre-puber, you know, who is totally innocent, has never had intercourse, just not even like animals have this instinct, you know. Okay, she's totally innocent, and here is an upgrading genetic engineering performed by Hermes, which is done in the middle of Eden, meaning Eden, Mesopotamia, Sumer, and by Enki, Ninma, and Hermes. And Hermes was the one to graft bone marrow from Enki and Ninma into Adamu and Tiamat. And this was done on their adolescent bodies. And this genetic engineering had two effects. The first one was to give them the gift, the capacity for procreating. And the second one was to bring them to the level of self-consciousness. And this was the most important thing. We have a lost book, which is also mentioned in the book, which is called in the book The Generation of Adams. I believe they are plural. And in the Sumerian tablet, it's called The Generation of Adapa. It's a little too complex, but you have two different generations in the Sumerian tablet. You have Adamu, which is the Adam of the Garden of Eden. And then you have Adapa, or with a higher upgrading of the genome. And then you will have unto Noah. And so when you see the difference in between the accounts that you have in Sumer and then the accounts that has been framed into a monotheist and a patriarchal and very moralistic time and civilization that came much like at least 2 millennia later, you reflect on how could they create a kind of trauma on the human race. I mean, for a deed that the poor Tiamat adolescent and innocent could not do. I mean, when you look at something as simple, I mean, I'm a psychologist, and I see in the Garden of Eden, the book rendition, an absolutely perfect double bind. You know, the double bind was a psychological process that had been described by Gregory Bateson. It meant that when the deity of the garden is saying, okay, you are going to tend the garden, you are going to work and pluck the fruits and do everything, those poor two first couple had never worked in Africa in the laboratory and house of Ninma and Enki. But here they are put to work, and then they are told you can eat all the fruits you want, but not of this specific tree in the center of the garden. And at the same time, there is another tree which is as even more important for the Anunnaki, which is a tree of immortality, because it is in all culture and in all over the tablets that they need absolutely the liquor, the elixir of immortality, and they can even, that's how they can even revive somebody who has been dead for a short time. So they were using this to keep their immortality. Even on Nibiru, Anu had the two trees also in his garden as emblems of his kingship of the whole, all the world. I mean, and so you have a double bind, because at no point, of course, you have Enki coming and Hermes, and we know what happened. But if you take only the book text, you realize that because they were forbidden specifically to eat the fruits of that tree, they would ask themselves all kinds of questions. And as the double bind works, they are pushed into being interested specifically in that tree, and finally, you know, they are kind of fascinated by that tree. This is a double bind. And why is it true as a psychological process? Is because at absolutely no point there was any problem with the other tree, which was not mentioned as being forbidden. And that's it. However, even in the book, we have the deity expelling the first couple by fear that they would at one point eat the tree, the fruit of the tree of immortality. And this is extremely interesting, because if you understand logically, if you analyze logically the text, given that in Sumer you had a tree of knowing which was linked to the DNA upgrading, but in the book you have the tree of knowing good and evil. So a very simple logic is that how can an adolescent be responsible for an act that she has done before eating the fruit that will give her the capacity to distinguish between good and evil? It's like she's at a pre-reasoning stage. So even there, you have no psychological ground for the overreaction of Enlil, who is upset against his brother because he had done an upgrading behind his back. And then in the book, you have the culpability and the responsibility for this being put on the victim. I mean, on the person, not victim, because we this was the most incredible gift we could get as far as humanity is concerned. And this is how we survived, because if we were not given, the capacity to reproduce, you know, we would not be here anymore. They would not have made clones. They needed the goddess to carry on the fetus and to give birth in order to have intelligent beings, you know. So they understood the education was needed. So how can such a trauma, and also how can you, not only that, but how can you curse all the descendants to the end of time? It's not, how can you put such a trauma, and how can somebody enlighten, and very little so in terms of psychology, I must say, how can somebody, again, you know, create such a trauma in a young species? This is a real problem.
Well, all my life I've wondered what is the matter with the human race. Why are we so often the way that we are? Despite our genetic similarity to some of the apes, we seem to be so different from the rest of life on the planet, and it's almost like we don't seem to fit here. You look at all the murder and the mayhem. And reflecting on that, if this theory has anything to it, it fills in a lot of the gaps, really, because at the end of the day, we would be just products of a flawed being flawed God, you know, beings who had all the differences that you see in the human race. Though we also point out in the book that perhaps in some ways we have moved beyond them in certain capacities, because a lot of the behavior that you detail that's, you know, comes, as say, from the tablets, these Anunnaki quote-unquote gods could be at times very immature, irrational, illogical, even self-sabotaging. And we do see those sort of paradoxical behaviors in ourselves.
Yeah, this is a very, I mean, the flaws are everywhere. The flaws in their character are everywhere, especially in the character of Enlil, who does not seem to have any kind of self-reflexive capacity, contrary to Enki, Ninma, and Hermes, Ningish Zida in the tablets. And this is the most disturbing information that we can get in the tablet, is that they were so short-sighted and so nombrilesque, you know, egocentric, that they went as far as the clan of Enlil, plus one son of Enki who was siding with them, whose name was Nergal. They were who got his wife Ereshkigal to give him all the secrets of her science. She was the one to take care of the laboratory, looking for the ice cap and all that. And he did that by raping her. Enlil also had such a bad slate in his past. And it's incredible how they went so far as, in order to just kill Marduk, the son of Enki, who could have been the next ruler of Earth, and he became the next ruler of Earth. They went as far as unearthing some awful weapons, seven of them, that Enki had hidden. And nuking, we know now it was a kind of nuclear energy. And they nuke not only the cities, the well-known Sodom and Gomorrah in Palestine, but also the spaceport, because Marduk had been directing the spaceport and the astronaut forever, on the base on Mars forever. So, and then they did not know. It seems they had not used them for so long. They had forgotten there was something called contaminated winds. And it so happened that they did not even check with the wind. And when they nuke Palestine, the winds were going towards Sumer. And they erased all life in Sumer and all the way to the Indus Valley, which was the domain of Inanna, great-granddaughter of Anu, and granddaughter of Enlil. And that's what we have on those skeletons. You must know the image are all over the web. The skeletons in the Indus Valley, the town Harappa, and they are highly they have radioactive energy extremely high, and that's it. So they destroy their own civilization. How can you do that? Well, we could do this still. We are still we are playing around with those nukes everywhere. How can we imagine that those nukes were on, you know, 24 hours a day and ready on target? I mean, what is this crazy thing? We needed a computer program in order to tell us that if one is starting, then the Earth is gone. So we are still able to also make the same kind of crazy, stupid decision, you know, that we are going to smash the enemy, you know. Voilà, that's it. We're still in the, my enemy is evil, and I am the one to be, the only one to be right. So we definitely have to move very, very fast, because now the what's coming is our cosmic, at least galactic, contact, you know, with the civilizations that are not only intelligent, but the greatest probability is that they are organized in some kind of federation. And of course, you may have a rogue civilization, but it's, you know, it's going to be about the same thing that we what we have now. But we have to be able to face an incredibly more advanced technology, and that's why they may be the best. But we have allies. We have allies in the Federation that were really trying their best to help us, and especially the all the people that has been that have been crushed because of their research, you know. And you can see very clearly what domains of research have been suppressed, what domains of information have been suppressed. And then it leads you to understand exactly who are those shadow powers and what they want to hide. And those domains are very clear. I've been starting by researching psi phenomena in America, in Princeton. Psi research has been considerably suppressed. The researchers have been turned into ridicule, and all the people researching ancient civilization, exo civilization, exopolitics have been turned into ridicule up to now. And I believe that we have to be the ones to, we are the ones to do the opening towards this new era. And we don't need anybody's giving us the permission. We are doing it because we are now so numerous to understand that we cannot be the sole little pearl of consciousness in the cosmos. It's the opposite. The consciousness is bathing, pervading the universe. And we are just getting there to be on par with those other civilizations, and we should be very proud.
Well, in terms of human development compared to, you know, where we are, as opposed to our potential, I think we're basically like teenagers, really, in our development, except that we're petulant teenagers with nuclear weapons, which is not usually a good combination. There's so much in your book that we've not been able to get to just because we'd be here all day. But as we begin to bring things to a close for today, I was just wondering, do the tablets or those that have been unearthed so far tell us anything about when the Anunnaki left Earth? Where did they go? Are they still out there? Can we expect this planet to come back again? I know there's entire books and websites devoted to the, you know, potential return of Nibiru.
Yes, I believe that if you take the standpoint that I'm taking, that we are on the verge of really interacting on a par and intelligently and through mass communications with intelligent civilizations that must certainly be already organized in some kind of federation, then we have to understand that, I mean, legalized freedom, it means that we take on us to free ourselves from the kind of submissive strategies that has been imposed on us by all those shadow powers, whatever they are, you know, the whole gamut of them. And we should not fear, even if we had, one Anunnaki in front of us, we have absolutely no reason in the world to listen to his order or to react as if he had something to say about the development of Earth. We have to take, we are the one to take care of Earth from now on, point, period. This is it. And all those people, they can do what they want, but they don't have a say in how we are going, all of us, all the human beings, to drive and to steer our planet, future and destiny. This is it. This is the kind of... So I'm totally against any fear that they would come back. Are they there? Here. I think they self-destroy. I mean, I believe that most of them died with the new king of Palestine. I mean, we have reports from the gods trying to flee, some asking Anu, what should I do? And of course, it was too late and they died, you know. I mean, they were writing laments, you know, you have them everywhere from each city. I mean, the dead were piled. I mean, they talk about some of them that were contaminated and died and were extremely sick. So that's it. That's what they did. I believe that most of them died. And I believe that even if there was one somewhere, you know, it does not have to be at the steering wheel. That's it. This is us now at the steering wheel.
Chris, today we've been talking about your book, just to remind listeners, DNA of the Gods. That subtitle is The Anunnaki Creation of Eve and the Alien Battle for Humanity. Before we close things off, tell listeners about your website. I know you've got a blog and at least one website, and anything else you'd like to share?
Yes, my blog, and you can see some few posts on... all these new discoveries of nomad planets and things like that. And also, there is going to be a conference on made by David Childress. It's going to be a conference on ancient aliens, and it's going to happen in Kempton, Illinois. So you can... I don't have this yet, but you can find it maybe on... David Childress Facebook page or website, you will find this. So that's going to be very interesting.
Well, in any event, we'll have all the links to the relevant stuff on your interview page. So, Chris, thanks once again for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. And thanks to everybody. That's great.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website, that's legalizefreedom.com, legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.